The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the hosts and their guests. They do not necessarily reflect the position of any associated employers or organizations.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Applied MMT podcast. We have a special guest joining again today. David Andolfato. David, very nice to have you on. I've followed your work on Twitter for a few years now and also your blog, and I've seen you interacting with some of the MMTers online. So we are very excited to have you on today. It'd be great if you could just tell us and your audience a little bit about your background.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Adam. It's a real pleasure to be here. I always enjoy having a conversation with intellectually curious people. My name is David Andolfato. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Miami. By way of my background, I was a professor of economics for about 20 years in the Canadian university system. A notable fact about my history is prior to that, I was actually a construction worker. And the reason why I mention that is because I actually lost my job during the great Volcker disinflation. So I really understand what that feels like. Although I was a young man at the time, it was still, an episode that really shaped a lot of my views going forward. I went back to school. I earned my PhD in Canada. I basically am a Canadian academic. I moved to the St. Louis Fed in 2009 during the financial crisis. Jim Bullard there, the new president, the new research director there, Chris Waller, who's now on the board of the Federal Reserve Board, made a call out to me to come down to help them build the research division. So I spent 13 years at the Fed as a senior policy advisor, working in the research division. And just recently in 2022, I made a move back to academia. I decided to come down to the Miami Herbert Business School and basically, go back to my roots in academia and try to, with the intent of teaching new generation, everything I've learned, my experience of the theory, the policy, and basically train the next generation of thought leaders. That's where I'm at today.
Excellent. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
A little bit warmer, I guess, than where you started.
It is a little bit warmer, though. The Pacific Northwest is not what most people think about it in terms of Canada. It's actually quite temperate. Rains a lot, it says. But yes, it's even warmer down here. Yes, it's true.
Excellent. So we usually like to kick off, asking our guests, maybe when they first came across MMT. So we'd love to hear just about, your kind of history and understanding of MMT, and maybe we can start from there and then go into where you agree and where you disagree. I think that'd be a great place for us to kick off.
All right. That's a good question. I guess it must have happened. This is one of the great things I think about Twitter and social media in general is that, I went on Twitter maybe 10 or 11 years ago. I can't remember now. I must have met these people on Twitter. I think this is one of the great benefits of social media is I got to meet all these people that I would not normally have met. I mean, prior to that, as an academic, the way you meet people is basically in conferences. That's a very, very kind of siloed group. But I must have come across people like Rohan Gray, Nathan Tankus, and later Sam Levy. Also corresponded, I guess, with Scott Fulweiler, a little bit with Stephanie Kelton on Twitter. And so that was how I became exposed to the MMT brand.
Gotcha. I feel like that's not uncommon. I feel like a lot of people stumbled across MMT on Twitter or other social media somehow.
Yeah.
Awesome. So how would you describe, like, I guess high level, we can start with high level, where, what you find valuable in MMT and maybe what you disagree with in MMT?
Yeah, it's kind of a slippery object here, because there's really, it's not even clear what What are the defining characteristics of MMT? I find that even within the community, people stress different things, different aspects, what they believe, what they don't believe, et cetera, et cetera. That's not a criticism. That's also true if I say neoclassical economics. I mean, there's a variety of interpretations of what that means. I often say that, well, I'm a mainstream economist, but I mean, I clearly differ with a lot of my colleagues. Right. Maybe I occupy some of the fringes of the mainstream, but and so my preference is actually not to compare really schools of thought, but you know, I'd rather talk to Sam Levy, for example, and see where we agree and where we disagree. Mm-hmm. Talk to Scott Fulweiler and see where we agree and disagree, or talk to Stephanie Kelton and to see what we agree and disagree. And because I think within the MMT crowd, like within any kind of group, there's even disagreements.
Yeah.
And then MMT within the broader class of heterodox schools of thought, there's very, very strong disagreements. So, but you know, it's people make statements, and then I kind of think about it, and the idea of the power of a monetary sovereign, for example, one thing that's true about my training, which is kind of not necessarily something that's shared with, you know, people who go through and do regular PhD, is I became focused on monetary theory. Uh-huh. And I kind of got into this crowd that was interested in the deep theory of money, like the question of why money. I mean, you know, not every society, small groups of individuals can conduct trade even without money. You know, I mean, this is something that anthropologists have documented, and we understand so-called social credit systems or gift-giving societies, whatever. And so, you know, I got tangled up with this crowd that was asking, you know, where does the demand, what is money, and where does the demand for money come from? And so, you know, this is in the tradition of, say, Neil Wallace in particular. And so I was accustomed to thinking about money in a very deep way because I was specialized in that track. Most economists actually don't.
Okay. Which shocks me.
Well, but it's true. I mean, yes, should it be shocking or not? Because the base type of models in economics are very much based on kind of real objects. Like economists go, money is basically a veil. What we care about is resource allocation. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is very much a theme that is emphasized by the MMT crowd. I mean, they worry about resource constraints.
Right.
Yeah, this is the first thing you're going to learn in a conventional neoclassical model is you're going to write down resource constraints, kind of social welfare functions, and then describe mathematically what optimal resource allocation looks like, independent of even any exchange, just from the perspective of even a social planner, a benevolent social planner. So even right at that basic level, you see the connection between what MMT emphasizes and what one learns in a course, a mainstream course. Now, then the next step in the classical training is the study of markets. But I mean, these markets are essentially moneyless markets, you know, because money is just viewed as a veil. You know, if you're a worker and you go to work for money and you spend the money on bread, you're really just trading labor for bread. That's what a neoclass, you know, the real exchange is how hard do I have to work for bread? That's the real price. That's the real wage measured in units of, and I think kind of that's kind of like the right emphasis, you know, and of course, in reality, we would have used money as a medium to effect that trade. Perhaps money, we might have bartered that exchange, but money might have facilitated, made it more efficient. But to a first approximation, so the view goes, the money is more of a veil, and what we care about more fundamentally is the exchange rate between labor power and bread. You know, that would be the type of thinking I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm just describing to you how the thought process goes, and the same thing with debt. You know, it's like, again, you know, if I borrow a dollar from you, the question is what do you use the dollar for? And then when you repay the dollar, what can that future dollar buy? Well, this is a trade-off now between current resources and future resources. The money, the monetary debt is just an intermediate step. And so the neoclassical or mainstream economists are kind of trained to kind of see through this veil and to see what the real allocation, the real prices are doing. And that's, I took a different view. I kind of thought money was, you know, that's not the basic training in economics. So maybe that's why I had an affinity with the MMT people, because of course they ascribe a much more prominent role to money in the economy.
I mean, it's just kind of crazy to think about. Like, if you were an alien, you know, coming from Mars or something, you came down and studied, you know, the, let's just keep it to the U.S., like the, you know, U.S. society and economy and stuff, and you listened in on conversations between people and you know, saw what what gets advertised, and but like, money is such a dominant conversation in literally everything that we like. It's so pervasive. Like, the idea that that would be like de-emphasized for some reason just seems like kind of crazy to me. Like, what, like, it doesn't really make sense that you would just sort of put that on the afterburner when it's such like at the forefront of so much of, you know, personal interactions and political discourse and the economy and everything else. It's such like an important, frequently spoken about topic, but then for some reason, I guess in a lot of the mainstream economics world, it's de-emphasized for some reason. That just strikes me as a little bit strange.
No, I mean, that's, Ryan, that's an excellent point. And I am very pleased to hear you use the alien metaphor, because I use it all the time. I use it at an even higher level. So I tell my classes, take a look. You know, I've showed up today. Starbucks gave me a latte. You know, actually, I asked them to imagine aliens looking down upon economic activity, not listening in on our conversations. Uh-huh. Imagine they're just observing. Okay. And that's what I mean by a bit higher. So they're not yet here tapped into our phones. So they're just observing. And what do they observe? They see me showing up in the morning delivering my lecture. They see me walking to the Starbucks. The Starbucks hands over a cup of coffee. They see that. And they don't see the electronic digits that are flying around in this great ledger in the sky. I mean, that's invisible. Right. But they do see Starbucks making a gift to me.
Right.
And then they see me walking to a lecture, preparing notes and delivering an impassioned lecture, trying to like impress my students with these ideas. And they go, my goodness, what a great effort. What was his compensation? Well, I don't know. They don't see my paycheck. They don't see my you know, they don't imagine they don't see these accounts. They're invisible. And then the students go off and they go work at the Starbucks and they go work and they do what appear to be favors for their fellow, people in the community. And it's just the economic activity from the perspective of this alien, I would say, is like, my goodness, all these people are going around doing each other favors. And it's like, I don't see any kind of money. It's just what is irrelevant. What's important is I got the Starbucks coffee.
Right.
What's important is I delivered the lecture. What's important is that the students went and worked. I mean, and that we're all working. The alien isn't going to see the money. What is more important? The actual activity? You know, my compensation in terms of how hard do I have to work for my Starbucks coffee? How hard do the students have to work to obtain a lecture from me? I mean, so, you know, I can use your alien example to kind of motivate why we should abstract from the money. Because now if we come down to your level and now the aliens start to tap into our conversations, you're absolutely correct, right? Where it's money, finance, stock values, everything's denominated in money. That's absolutely correct. But to answer your question, I don't think it is so crazy to abstract from money at a very high level.
Uh-huh. That's fair.
Yeah.
I'm going to, since it's a little bit tangential to this idea of what money is, David, and also thanks for joining. One of the things I kind of run the social front, the social media front to our endeavor here. And so I live stream quite often. One of the things that last night, actually, we were live streaming. One of the things we were doing with the group is going over the discussion you had with Eric Des Moines. Is that how you say his last name? And part of that discussion that I was hoping that maybe you could just help me understand better is you said something to the extent of, Adam, you remember this part, so correct me if I'm quoting this wrong, but some of the extent of if the government diminishes the purchasing power of the money or the currency, then that is an effective default. Something like that. Yeah. I might not be quoting it perfectly.
Oh, I understand it.
Okay. Correct the quote if I quoted it wrong, but can you just help me understand what you meant by that? And I think that maybe give me a little bit better window in terms of just how you see money.
No, absolutely. And actually, I should say that view that you just expressed, the government diminishing, what is the word for it? Debasing the currency, I guess.
Debasing the currency.
Is in the tradition of the economics, the neoclassicals I described, they would view that as economically equivalent to a default. So, but what is meant by that? I mean, clearly, it's not an outright legal default. So, I mean, I make a distinction. You know, I mean, the Treasury is never going to default.
Right. Correct. Yep. What you did in the conversation. Yeah.
But there's a quite. You know, this is the situation. Imagine. You can push back against this view, but I guess the view that they would adopt is, imagine that the policy is an inflation target. Let's suppose that the official inflation target is zero. Let's suppose over the long run, or even the short run, I guess. So you're trying to like just keep zero inflation or as close to possible, okay? And you're part of the Fed, which is part of the government in some sense. And, you know, you're trying to convey to the population that the policy, the monetary fiscal policy, we're going to do a lot of things. But I mean, among other things, we're going to try to anchor the value of the currency as measured by, say, the CPI or the PCA price index. We're going to try to keep inflation pretty close to zero. For off into the indefinite future, okay? This is what we're going to try. This is our promise to you. Sometimes there might be slight deviations or things we can't control, but by and large, you can bet that we're going to keep inflation pretty close to zero over the 3, 5 years, 10 years. Okay, great. Well, now, individuals in the economy, they write long-term contracts. Long-term contracts are nominal, okay? And when you write down a nominal contract, you know, a 10-year contract, you have to have a view as to what, you know, if a debt instrument promises to repay you in 10 years, $100, you have to ask yourself, what is the price level going to be 10 years from now? You know, if the price level is going to be 10 times higher, I mean, that $100 is not worth anything. And so one has to form a view as to what the purchasing power of that, say that the example of a 10-year debt instrument, when I contract with a private individual or a government, whatever, and I say, you promise to deliver to me $100 10 years from now, I don't care what you say. You must have some view, either explicitly or implicitly, that $100 that you receive 10 years from now has a purchasing power. Mm-hmm. And that purchasing power has to be anchored by the promise that the government made to keep inflation low and stable on a 10-year horizon. Okay. Are you with me? This is the thinking. Okay. And so now people in the economy are designing contracts. It could be wage contracts, insurance contracts, pension funds are promising rates of return. Mm-hmm. Corporate interest rate, whatever. I mean, you're making nominal contracts on the basis of a kind of promise in quotes, that the price level is going to be stable out for a long period of time. Okay, suppose a new government comes in and kind of goes, we changed our mind. we feel like it might be even a legitimate a cause. Maybe, you know, there's hungry children and there's schools that need to be constructed, and we're going to finance it by basically, not by taxing. I mean, and we can have this discussion about taxes, I know, later, but by just basically expanding the supply of government paper, whether it's treasury issuance or money doesn't matter so much, but the effect of this is to basically create new money that takes purchasing power away from the private sector, you know, assuming that we're in full employment and all that sort of stuff. The point is that from the perspective of the people who were kind of counting on a stable price, you know, mm-hmm. It's to the extent that this government action results in a higher price level than otherwise would have prevailed, and I have a 10-year nominal contract that was based on the previous promise, there is an economic sense, however well justified it was, there is an economic sense in which the debt holder, it's as if you defaulted on them. It's not a legal default. It could be perfectly legitimate. But from the perspective of the person holding that paper, it's as if you defaulted on it. That's the thinking that goes on in the minds of kind of the neoclassical mind.
Are you defining this in nominal terms or in real terms, in the sense of the issue I'd have, or like the immediate thing that comes to mind, would be something to the extent of, I don't see how you can get growth, economic growth, new business endeavors spun up and all that good stuff, without an increase of what credit. Commenters would call the money supply, which to me would be either new bank credit or just the government coming in and spending. Mm-hmm. And so it would seem if you were to achieve, we'll call it as close to zero inflation as you could, you're gonna have just very dull growth during that entire time frame. Yeah. But maybe what you're saying is kind of this defaulting in real terms, but not in nominal terms. So like you'd still get an expansion, or I'm sorry, you'd still get a situation where you're getting purchasing power diminished nominally, but in real terms, it's increased. Is that what you're saying?
You're asking two questions. I mean, let me try to. Yes, you asked about the default question. And we both agreed that what we have in mind is not an explicit legal default.
But what we mean
is an economic default. And what does that mean?
That the promise is not being kept.
The promise is loose, right? It's like, the government is issuing paper or with a promise that the purchasing power 10 years hence is going to be a particular range.
And that
promise. And I said, it could be legitimate reasons. I mean, I'm not saying that, that you might want to, sometimes we call this an inflation tax, right? But there might be a reason for doing it. But the point is, from an economic perspective, from the perspective of a bondholder, it's as if, you know, the price level stayed constant, but the government defaulted on 10% of the bond repayment. You know, it's economically, it's equivalent. So that's the first step. The second question, the second point you raised about the need for kind of expansion of money is, well, I mean, that may or maybe not be true. That is, if you take a look, for example, at even U.S. history in the 19th century, in the post-Civil War era, if I recall the data correctly, and of course the Civil War was an era of high inflation, but in the post-Civil War era, I guess, you know, there was a view to kind of reestablish the price level anchor, and the broad characteristics of economic development in the late 19th century for the U.S. is, if I recall correctly, is basically 60 years of deflation. The late 19th century was also a period of very rapid economic growth, by the way, for the United States, albeit, you know, the westward expansion, although there were several financial crises as well. But just to get to your point, you know, people sometimes ask, is inflation or inflationary monetary expansion necessary for economic prosperity? it's not so clear cut. I think Mike Bordo and Angela Reddish once wrote a paper called Good Inflations and Bad Deflations. You know, you can kind of point to episodes where, in fact, even moderately deflationary periods are not inconsistent with real growth. So we have to be a little bit careful.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the problem I would have with some of that, and I kind of sympathize with, you know, the overall message of going back on, you know, issuing a promise that you couldn't keep or what have you. Mm-hmm. Part of me it kind of reminds me of like in the corporate world, right? Like company defaults / liability management exercises, you know, for distressed issuers or something, yeah, as those being economically equivalent, right? Where, okay, technically, you know, there was no default, but, you know, the company, did some sort of exchange with bondholders and the bondholders took a haircut on, the principal value of the paper that they were holding, and but the company didn't technically default, didn't have to file for Chapter 11 or something. To me, it's kind of in a similar vein of just like not keeping your promises. So I can somewhat sympathize with that, but I guess the broader question is like when we're talking about inflation and the price level and stuff. From my perspective, the real thing is about prices and purchasing power, and not necessarily money per se, like money supply per se. It's really about going back to what you were saying about the contracting process and stuff that happens all the time in the economy, that sort of establishes, you know, current and future prices at which people are transacting. And to me, that's what inflation is about, is it's about prices and not about, money supply, per se. And we've even gone so far as to say that, or at least like I've made the argument in the past before, that when people talk about the government debt and deficits and stuff, and oh, if the deficit's too high, is that going to lead to inflation? And I would push back on something like that and say, well, I think that a higher deficit is actually evidence of inflation already happening by government decree. Yeah. Right. It's just kind of the accounting record of, higher prices paid for, whatever it is that the government is purchasing. Right. If the government buys a barrel of oil for, $70 one month and pays the next month pays $90 a barrel. Well, that deficit and the price paid is going higher. That balance is going to increase. That's sort of evidence of, the government paying higher prices for things. So that's one thing where I feel like a lot of these the mainstream economics and kind of get these things backwards, where it's saying, if the government, if the deficit's too high or the debt, there's too much debt or something, the government, could always print money, but that's basically just creating inflation. And I'm like, I don't really think that that's correct. I think that it's the inflation that happens when the actual contracts are executed, when the transactions happen, mm-hmm. right? When you say, okay, like, you will pay $60,000 a year, for your military service. That's, establishing a price. If the next year you say, okay, now I'm going to pay $65,000, that in and of itself is the inflation. That's the higher price. And you know, the deficit is sort of like the evidence or the accounting record of the higher prices paid for real stuff. Yeah. So that's sort of I don't know if you have if that makes sense to you or not, but I thought I'd throw that at you.
Yeah, I think I have these conversations with Warren Mosler.
Yep.
In particular, and you know, I go, Warren, come on. It's like, I think we're just talking past each other to some extent, but I mean, and you know, Warren is a big proponent of this view. I mean, look, I mean, ultimately the government is the monopoly issuer of the currency. And so the government can basically, you know, if it decides to pay X for bread, I mean, that's going to be the price of bread, and you know, thank you for your military service, 60,000 next year, 65. I mean, one question I would have, just tangentially, is like, why would the government want to raise? Why would the government want to raise these prices?
Oh, I think that's a good question. Okay,
so you know, okay, there's that. But then I say, well, Warren, you know, if I take a look at even a very simple-minded kind of quantity of money theory of the price level, you know, take a very 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 naive type of quantity theory equation, you know, MV equals PEY, you know, if you know what I'm talking about. And you know, and Milton Friedman would say, okay, well, MV, V is velocity, that's money demand is basically stable. So let's fix that. And PY is not nominal GDP. At full employment, Y is real GDP. And so now there's a, you know, M and P are proportional to each other. P is proportional to M, and M is proportional to P. And Milton Friedman will say, to get price level determination, the government has to set M. It has to determine the quantity of outside money. And what Warren is saying, no, what the government sets is P, and the money supply accommodates itself to the P. And I go, I don't, but whatever. It's mathematically, it's isomorphic. And so maybe we're just talking past each other. I don't know. Uh-huh. So that's one thing. I mean, you know, whether the government chooses the quantity of money in this framework or the price is isomorphic. So that's one thing. But the other thing I'd like to say in terms of that view is, you know, I mean, I don't know. You know, I have to think about it, but how, I think there are answers to this question, but, you know, I'll take a look at the price level in the United States over long periods of time, like the last 100 years. And if you take a look at the CPI, for example, of course it's measured like not very well, but whatever, what do you notice? You notice, you know, inflation has been very volatile, you know, and it typically spikes up during war time, you know, First World War comes up. In the Great Depression, you know, we had deflation. I mean, the Second World War, after price controls were raised, you know, you had a burst of inflation. You had a little bit more inflation during the Korean War, and then you see inflation coming down, and then you see kind of some inflationary pressures build up during the Vietnam War. So, you know, but over that entire century, the price level on average did not rise by very much. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, starting about 1971 in the 70s, you know, you see something different. You know, you observe what's called the great, you know, peacetime inflation, although we were fighting the Vietnam War. And we had, excuse me, there was somebody at the door. You can, you know, just take a look at the price level. I mean, starting in 1971, the price level is no longer stationary. It just goes up. Now you kind of have to ask yourself, was there any event around in the early 70s that kind of might you know explain that break? And you know, then the most obvious event at that time was when Nixon went off the gold standard in 1971, and so prior to that, of course. The U.S. and many other economies were trying to anchor their monetary and fiscal policies in particular ways, centered around a gold standard, however you want to define it, that was sometimes, you know, they went off the gold standard during periods of fiscal stress, like war times. They went back on it when the crisis passed. But if we were naively to take Warren's interpretation of the cause of inflation, I mean, I find it very curious that it was only after 1971 that the government started to really want to like raise prices in a systematic manner. I just find that I don't know.
You know what's so funny is you talk about the early 70s, and my mind immediately, I know that like this is like such a standard meme is or trope is to talk about like leaving the gold standard, but my mind actually immediately goes to the oil crisis.
Sure.
And thinking about how, I guess, you know, and I think Warren's talked about this, the Texas Railroad Commission or whatever set the price of oil, and then you know, that was a monopoly, and then it got kind of I guess the Saudis took over as a swing producer of oil, and so they kind of you know, got this sort of monopolistic price power, and so that's essentially what caused that sort of you know, that price shock from, you know, from the Saudi Arabia raising price of oil is, you know, that kind of pricing just sort of worked its way through the economy and fed into, you know, the price of food and the price of gasoline, obviously, and everything else. And that was what really caused that initial burst of inflation in the 70s. And then, you know, when you think about all of the other, you know, periods of inflation, you know, whereas World War I, World War II, and you know, this recent thing, I mean, it's often centered around energy and energy and shortages. And, you know, if there is some sort of political conflict and you know, you don't have as you know, you've got countries that are hoarding precious natural resources, you know, the prices of those things are going to go up. And also, you know, in terms of World War II, or World War I too, like, you know, the entire structure of the economy changes towards, you know, the war effort. And so, you know, other, you know, consumer goods and services become much more scarce. And so that can put upward pressure on prices. And so, I guess it seems like it could perhaps also be, you know, have something to do with the gold standard. But the way I think about the gold standard is just like, it was essentially a form of top down, essentially credit controls on banks, right? Because because there was an actual legal limit to the amount of credit you can extend as a bank if you didn't have sufficient gold reserves. And so you do away with that. And, you know, you create a much more flexible, you know, currency system that doesn't have this really sort of top down centrally controlled arbitrary you know, limitation. So I guess it could be true that might have something to do. It certainly has is related, I think, to broader bank credit growth over the last 50 years, but I don't necessarily see that as, again, if we think of things in terms of prices and availability of real resources, you know, it always seems to be around these geopolitical conflicts, and, you know, all of a sudden oil gets scarce and it's, you know, and the price of everything goes up, and that's sort of reflecting the real cost of you know, it's harder to accumulate you know, those resources that are necessary for the economy.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I don't think there's very much I'm going to disagree with in what you said, in fact. So, you know, of course, during the 70s, I mean, I lived through the 70s, uh-huh. A period of terrible fashion.
Yeah.
You should see my pink shirts and my long hair and I had high heel boots too. I mean, it was like my bell bottoms. You know, I remember the OPEC oil embargo, I think it was in the fall of 1973, that quadrupled the price of oil overnight, basically, a huge shock, uh-huh. You know, and there were many adjustments that had to be made. You know, at the time, America was these big gas guzzlers making, you know, six miles to the gallon. You know? And then we had the subsequent oil shock associated with Iran and Iraq, I guess, later in the decade. And in between, we had all these commodity price shocks. You know, the anchovies disappeared off the coast of Peru. I mean, price of beef was going up. People were investing in turtle meat and substance. And that's absolutely true. But the point is that whatever the regime, the monetary regime was in place before, monetary fiscal, and I guess when I state that, we should consolidate the central bank, the treasury, the fiscal authority, and the banking sector.
Yep.
And there was always a mean reversion. The inflation often was followed by a deflation or something, and that did not happen subsequent to the 1970. But now, why was that? I think, you know, it's like you said. I mean, it's not necessarily something that permitted the bank sector now. I mean, I don't think Friedman might not disagree with this. I mean, Friedman might say something, and who knows? I mean, the guy's like not around. But I mean, we basically replaced gold with government fiat. Okay, so the settlement the ultimate settlement object in the banking right. system now has been replaced with something anchored to gold. So that's something just purely by fiat. So there's that. And then, of course, there's the at the same time, though, you know, I guess there's the fiscal side, too. I mean, the treasury securities, what role this plays, but. I guess if I hear what you're saying, I mean, you're just suggesting that, you know, we're talking about inflation here. I mean, you are ascribing it more to kind of these exogenous shocks, the supply shocks that happen in crisis, and how that interacts with the existing bank, you know, whatever regulates the banking sector, which is the ultimate source of the money that we commonly use, something like that. And then it's the government that's setting the prices, and the banks are basically supplying the money and credit to accommodate whatever those prices are.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And right. Friedman would go, "That's right. That's possible." And even in modern economics, we accept that. But what you get now is some degree of price level indeterminacy. Like, what determines the price level? Warren's answer is, "Well, it's just the government." The government chooses how much to pay its soldiers. Well, okay, fine. And then why doesn't the government just keep the price level constant? I mean, I don't know. I just
I think there's a – yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people would argue that it probably should. But I would also just say, like, you know, we were talking about contracts before, and ultimately contracts are enforceable in courts, which is also part of the government, right? And – I posed a question. I don't know, I remember if this was on our podcast or if this is offline or something, but I would have to imagine that there are certain types of contracts that where the price was just so stupid that it's stupidly high or something like that, that like a court could just rule it basically unenforceable. Like if I said I want to buy your house for, you know, $200 trillion, like that's obviously not. That's not like a real price. That's just not like, and so I would tend to think that actually, like, you know, because there's this, you know, they say in financial markets too, like they'll say, oh, well, you know, theoretically, you know, a stock could go to infinity. And it's like, no, it can't. That's actually, there is actual structural limitations to, you know, prices and how things work. Because it's like, look, if something actually got too big, you know, that actually represents real P&L on broker dealers' balance sheets. And at some point, you know, their risk manager taps them on the shoulder and says, hey, like, look, we gotta exit this thing. We can't be trading this anymore. There's too much P&L. We don't have enough bank capital to deal in these securities anymore. So there are actual structural limitations to things like prices and stuff. Yeah. And I feel like that doesn't the government, i.e. the court system, and you know, if I think one could reasonably argue that the banks are functionally government agents, mm-hmm. are kind of work to enforce that. From that perspective, I think it's kind of true. It may not be explicitly in terms of, you know, what we think of, you know, Congress and, you know, congressional appropriations and that sort of thing. But from a broader, higher level perspective, yeah, like, you know, the government does kind of, by governing contracts and markets and stuff, you are kind of governing price.
Yeah. Like I say, I mean, at a very, you know, kind of naive level, that quantity theory equation is kind of consistent with that. It's like, do you take the view that the government and, or, you know, and kind of the broader infrastructure is determining the prices, and that there, and that, the, and then that the financial system accommodates,
right,
by basically, you know, providing the liquidity and the funds that are needed to support economic activity at those prices. That is one view. I think there's a that's quite a legitimate view. Or, you know, you can take the other extreme and say, well, I mean, look, the government's just going to permit so much money and credit in the economy. You guys are going to have to. That's obviously going to put limits
right.
on the cost of living, because, I mean, you can demand as much price as you want. There's, you know, if there's only $1 in the economy, I mean, it's just not going to support that price. And so you can imagine the other way where, you know, you're trying to or control the balance sheet, if you like, of the government, the central bank, whatever you think determines the price level more directly. And the prices are going to accommodate themselves just through the negotiations and on the basis of the availability of money and credit. I think as a logical statement, I mean, both views are correct. I mean, and then the question is kind of how is it actually done in reality? You know what? I mean, it's probably a bit of both. And then there's a theoretical question is like, how should this be done? You know, if one wanted to control, say, provide a nominal anchor to keep inflation low and stable, how should one do it? Should one kind of target the aggregates and let the prices adjust? Or should one take a more active role in kind of managing, you know, price controls, for example, in theory, that might work out, but in practice, how has it worked out? What are the difficulties of the practical implication of both, you know, or should we use interest rate control? You know, I mean, these are ongoing questions and discussions that we have all the time.
Sorry about that. On that topic, I would love to ask you, and I know we are coming up on time here, but as someone who has spent time at the Fed, I don't know if you know Mosler's stance on monetary policy, but his take is that the Fed essentially has it backwards. And he believes that raising rates actually stimulates the economy with debt to GDP where it is right now.
We very much subscribe to that view. we've basically been pounding the table about that over since the launch of this project like 15 months ago. So
yeah, I actually have a blog post on that recently that I'll refer you to after. But yeah. First of all, I as usual, I mean, I'm right in the middle. You know, it's like I'm at a place where everybody hates me. Main Street hate me. The MMT, everybody hates me because I'm always like right in the middle because I can see legitimacy in Warren's views. I can see it.
Yeah.
It comes from the mathematics of the models I work with. This is not even my opinion. This what Warren says is actually a property of the models I work with in some regions of the parameter space. So the problem with Warren is he states things unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, the things he says are propositions that follow under some conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the value of working with mathematical models, it helps us try to identify what those conditions are.
Right.
And so, yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you consider a government that like set taxes to zero because it has the ability to print money and it's not concerned about redistribution or stuff like that, it just needs to finance its spending. It can just print money. I mean, even Milton Friedman advocated this back like 60 years ago. Okay. And now imagine you want to pay interest on that money. Well, how are you going to finance that interest if you're not taxing? Mm-hmm. If you have no other, you've got to print more money. This is the most basic monetarist proposition I can think of. It's Neil Wallis taught me this 30, 40 years ago. If you pay interest on money, bonds, government bonds, you know, government money, and you finance that interest payment by printing more money, you're going to create inflation.
Right.
One of the fundamental tenets of basic monetary theory.
Right.
It's like consistent with what Warren is saying. So, okay, David, you're at the Fed. How can you believe this? Do you think higher interest rates create inflation? Well, no, let's be careful. And in my blog, I say, I think, first of all, one has to make a distinction between changes in the interest rate and the level of the interest rate.
That's fair.
So I think that if the Fed was to increase the interest rate to 10% tomorrow or 20%, or like Volcker did when I was working as a young man in the construction sector, I think you're going to see disinflation. I think you're going to see unemployment. You're going to see disinflation. And I lived through it. Warren, I'm sorry. And inflation's coming down. But I think I interpret.
Can I cut in and just ask why you think 10% would be disinflationary?
Because it would create a massive recession, like in the 81, 82 recession. I'd get laid off. I'm not making money. I can't make my payments. I'm not going to be able to buy that car. I mean,
why would you get laid off?
Oh, I mean, that's very, very simple. I mean, if you saw, for example, I mean, when I lived through, I was in Vancouver, British Columbia, working in the construction sector, and I saw real estate, I saw housing prices drop by 30% in the matter of a couple of months. I saw mortgage rates were going up to 20%. People were not paying their mortgages.
And this was in the 80s, you said?
1981, 82.
Yeah. Okay. Just to make sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And just the demand for projects. I was working in construction, so I was working in doing hospitals, shopping malls. I was also working on the side, doing piece rate like renovations, where I was not on a fixed wage. And by the way, those were my first jobs that disappeared, the flexible wage jobs. Higher interest rate to buy a car. It's tougher to finance it. I can't afford the car. I can't buy that stereo equipment. The producers start laying off workers. They can't afford to buy stuff. I mean, it's the classic, aggregate demand story. So if you take a look at the evidence, I mean, inflation came down very rapidly. But I say, the question is, and this is where I think Warren is right, is like, what happens after that? Mm-hmm. Like, now that Volcker has interest rates at 10 or 20%, can we rely on inflation to stay low? Mm-hmm. And I'm going, we can't do the counterfactual, but in our models we can. But in my model, I mean, if Volcker had kept interest rates at high.
Yeah.
And then after the long and variable lags have worked their way through, the question is how does the Treasury finance those payments? And if there's no fiscal support, if there's no taste for raising taxes or anything, the economy's not growing. Well, the arithmetic tells you that you're just going to have to print more paper. And that's just, now we're going back to the monetarist proposition that if you have high interest rates and you're going to finance it by basically treasury issuance or printing paper, basically, that's going to be inflationary in the long run. So this was just a long-winded way of me saying that, yes, I think Warren is correct, but there's a caveat. Like, there's a difference between the change in the interest rate.
Right.
The effect that has in the short run during the, which could be long and variable lags. And then there's the question of how does the fiscal authority react to that high interest expense. In the 1980s, even though you had the famous Reagan deficits, what people often neglect is after the initial Reagan tax cut in 1981, that the Reagan administration subsequently overturned many of those cuts and actually raised taxes. There was broad bipartisan support, the Blue Dog Democrats, et cetera, in trying to do something about the deficit. And indeed, by the 1990s, the deficit went into negative territory. It was actually a surplus, which I know to the MMT crowd is terrible but it's like I'm just describing stuff.
Yeah.
The point is that Warren's statement is true in the models I work with under some stated conditions. I think Warren is wrong to state it as an unqualified truth. And the other thing to note, too, is what many people will point out is that the interest income that is generated through this mechanism doesn't go to the high marginal propensity to consume people. It typically goes to the people who save. So it's not even going to be necessary.
This is where...
Do you mind if I take this? So my big call in 2022 was stocks were going to, and just for the record, I'm far more interested in the finance side than necessarily like the policy and economic side. So my big call was at the end of 2022 was that we were about to enter a big boom period. And I'm saying this to just try it on for size. Get your take on this, but I am very much in the camp that higher rates are always inflationary. And we'll always, and I can explain what I think happened in the 70s and into the 80s. But the thought is that, and this is what I was kind of pushing on, the why question for, well, why would you get laid off, right? And my argument would be that that you wouldn't have gotten laid off in like the 1980s had there not been a collapse of income because inflation was so high in relative terms, right? And the income channel would be the government spending. And I can, it's on a podcast, it's going to be hard to see, obviously, but I can send you the chart where in real terms, deficit spending was actually contracting during the 70s and 80s. And yeah. So that's what kicked the layoffs. Now, if we were to jack interest rates to 10 or 15% today, yeah. I think it would only do what exactly it did heading into 2023, which is just boost things even more, right? We would get a higher run up in asset prices. There would be even more income to the private sector that would juice things even more, and you'd never get a recession. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the idea there. And I don't see how higher interest rates are ever contractionary for the business cycle either, because what they're doing too, right? If you need new loans to be created to continue business growth, they're actually helping out the banks, not hindering them. And they're helping out asset managers, not hindering them, because now they're getting effectively a higher risk-free rate. And if I'm an asset manager and I need to, I have some allocation I can get to risky and some allocation I have to put to safe assets. If I'm getting paid, let's say tomorrow, 15% on my safe assets, then I can take the biggest risk in the world. I can approve any loan because I'm getting my 15% on you know, whatever portion of the portfolio. And I know eventually some of that will have to go to depositors and that'll be handed off. But I see higher rates as a, and I got to be careful here with how I say benefit, but all I mean is kind of expansionary across the board, and certainly in the way that I kind of model things, I see that as an expansionary item, and it would take a fiscal collapse or inflation just taking off to really stop that business cycle from expanding. So I've talked to Warren many times. I'm not going to speak for him, but there's certainly the part of us MMTers that are in that camp that are saying higher rates are actually expansionary. And what took place in the 70s and 80s is its own isolated incident. And I would say for a counterfactual too, if it was higher rates that crashed the economy in the 70s into the 80s and lower rates should be expansionary, then when we did have a 0% interest rate for about a decade there, growth was very mundane, and you never saw any major credit cycles during that time frame. The credit cycle was always very compressed, and we never had any big booms or busts for that decade. And it was only a decade that we had that policy in place. But that would be an example of a counterfactual where you'd expect something to happen, and it never did, kind of given stated policy. And again, the reason I think it would never happen is banks can't take on risk in a 0% interest rate setting, because they have to gobble up all of their space with a very low yielding safe asset, and so they just can't make any risk. So that's kind of the applied MMT thought on interest rates, and I'll let you riff for a while.
Yeah, no, very, points very well taken, Douglas. That's right. So. Well, what can I say? I mean, I live through Volcker. I mean, I have no doubt that if the Fed raised rates high enough, sharply enough, it'd create a great disruption in financial markets. And yes, you'll get a higher yield on your risk-free treasury, but I mean, you're going to see loan demand collapse. I mean, so that part of your... and plus, you're going to see.
Honest curiosity here. Have you guys ever done any causal inference or any sort of statistical studies on loan demand and higher rates over a long time frame, time series? I mean, I'm sure that had been done, but can you point me towards something like that?
No, not right now. But okay, I okay. Look for it.
Yeah. Okay, okay.
Just if you'll permit me to continue on.
Yeah, go ahead. Yep.
On commenting on what you said, and so I already granted that Warren is correct in some sense. I mean, there's interest income. It's income to the private sector. Let's even forget the foreign sector for the moment. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just the Fed raises the interest rates and of course you're going to earn a higher interest income on your treasury portfolio, and it's going to affect the interest income that people who hold financial wealth are going to benefit from that. And, okay, fair enough. But I made a distinction between changes. Sudden changes, yep. not just little changes, but hypothetically large changes,
yep.
and the level. So I made that. So, but even in regard to the level, though, I want to challenge you a little bit on that because so now you ask me about some evidence. have you looked at the cross country evidence? I wonder. Like, we can go to South America, for example, for examples of very high interest rate regimes, and study how the private sector is functioning in Argentina, Brazil, where interest rates are very, very high. Inflation is also very high too. So, it's not so clear to me that the stimulatory effect of high interest rates is the way you're. I mean, I'm not denying that there's an element there, but the macro economy is a complicated place. The other thing that you neglected to mention was in the 2020, 2021, we had massive fiscal injection. I mean, over $5 trillion of, I think even if interest rates had remained flat, you would have seen, some effect from the massive increase in household sector wealth that would have, powered the economy forward. But this is just classic neoclassical economics. We would expect this helicopter drop of outside money and debt to kind of power the economy. The question is really whether the high interest rates policy accelerated it or not. I mean, initially when the Fed started raising, what did you see happen to stock prices and home prices, Douglas? I saw actually weakening, especially in duration assets, when the Fed was starting to raise interest rates. Now, remember, not I'm talking about the change. When the Fed started raising aggressively, I saw the stock market actually weakening. I saw the acceleration of home prices actually decelerate. I saw all the classic effects of what I perceive to be a change in the interest rates on stock market wealth, household wealth through their real estate holdings. And true, recently it's rebounded, but the Fed hasn't raised anymore. I mean, it's kept it's kept the interest rate high, but it hasn't continued to increase them. And so again, I think, I'd be a little bit careful in if I interpreted you correctly, and maybe I didn't, but you're ascribing a lot of stimulatory power to the fact that you have high interest rates here. Yes, maybe a little bit, but I think there's other things going on. And then I'd encourage you to kind of try to corroborate kind of your views with evidence from other countries. And I think there you're likely to find, although I'd welcome to do this investigation with you, we might find that the evidence there is less supportive of the view you just expressed.
Yeah. If in other countries, I would, I'll admit I've spent very little time looking outside the U.S. One, because of the work like yourself and many others at the St. Louis Fred and whatnot. Data is so abundantly available in the U.S. and it's so easy to come by at such a granular level. It's very helpful for those who are trying to build up various models. But one of the things that almost every other country has that the U.S. doesn't have is the fact that the other countries are quite often creating loans in dollars. Even the central bank is very reliant on dollars itself. So it always gets a little skewed. Regarding 2022, and I can say this chart on Twitter, if your DMs are open or something like that, I'll send it to you. But 2022, I was very bearish into 2022. And with regards to how the rate is going to affect ultimately asset prices, it's going to be that it's going to kick off the cycle. So in 2022, one of the charts that I follow very closely is the change in deficit spending year over year. Mm-hmm. In real terms. The real is the important part. But either way, if you look at 2022, that was only the third time in the last like 30 or 40 years that we'd ever gone negative in real. So essentially, in real terms, we were rate of change perspective in a surplus, right? So, you know, from an MMT perspective, you're removing net financial assets at that time, in part because of the we had the largest tax drain in the history of the U.S. In 2022, and so I was very bearish up until the end of 2022, when because of the interest rates, we were starting to see at that point the massive flood of the interest income kick things off in early 2023. Right. So, to at least I agree, I'm quite ignorant on the rest of the world and haven't spent the time looking at the rest of the world and the implications of that on various global economies. With the U.S., though, just to kind of hit drive home that one point, though, again, very bearish into 2022 because of this contracting, fiscal that was taking place. And my point was, actually, had the Fed never raised interest rates, we would be in a recession right now. Had the Fed stayed at zero, we would be in a recession, and we would have never gotten out of the contraction.
That's an interesting
the contraction that
that's an interesting counterfactual. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised to hear an MMT proponent talk about real deficits. I thought it was always something
that always nominal.
The neoclassical guys are always correct, but I mean, we should talk. I mean, we should talk on Twitter. I'd be curious.
Yeah, right on.
And that's an interesting take.
Yeah, we can definitely share. Douglas has put together some really impressive models and stuff that we have on our data dashboard on our site. And, you know, just to kind of piggyback off what Douglas was saying, like we've said this on this podcast before, I can live with someone, making the argument that, the stock market weakness in 2022 was, at least the initial dip was, kind of a one-time reset, on the risk-free rate. Fine, but if to me it seems the fiscal drain, both in real and nominal terms, was so massive. Again, we had a trillion the in nominal terms. You look at 2022 versus 2021. It was the deficit was $1 trillion less. So when you think about and again, David, you emphasized rates of change and stuff. That is the largest year-on-year reduction in the federal deficit in history. And in April 2022, it was like a $300 billion tax drain. It's the largest tax inflow into the Treasury ever, and that never gets discussed in financial market circles, which is just kind of shocking, right? Like the federal government is removing all this purchasing power, like huge drain all at once, and the market tanks, and there's not any sort of consideration for it. It's just, to me, it's kind of like, if people want to make the argument of what the primary driver is, fine, but it's not even part of the conversation, which to me is just somewhat shocking.
Well, I'm guilty of that as well. I'll go back and reconsider what you said. But from my perspective, kind of bird's eye view, is I kind of see the from a slightly different angle. I mean, what I see is a massive, over 2 years, $5 trillion injection, basically, of paper that's not going to be reversed. And so, and by the way, I was a proponent of that. I'm actually, it's not like I thought that was basically the right thing to do. But I also understood the likely inflationary consequences of that, and I'm okay with that. But the point is basically, to a first approximation, you've expanded the balance sheet. I mean, I think maybe what you're concentrating on the flow, Mm-hmm. You know, and of course there was a massive decline. I mean, but there was a massive increase. I mean, how can you ignore right. that massive yeah. increase?
Exactly.
That massive increase is not going to just disappear. That household, private sector is carrying that balance sheet forward in time.
Right.
So if you have a flow.
Yeah, supportive of corporate earnings.
Yeah. If you have a contraction, you know, because the programs have expired and oh, okay, fair enough. Imagine that the ARP was continued for another year. Or 2 years. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know. So for me, I wasn't focused so much on the expiration of this spending because I thought that there's just this stock of outside wealth was going to carry basically, you know, the long and variable lags that we talk about all the time. So, but you've motivated me to go back and look actually at that. I mean, flows like that do matter, I guess, in reality, even if they matter less in theory. But I mean, yeah, you know, again, you can please send me the analysis and I'll definitely have a look
sure.
at it. But.
Sure.
Awesome.
And one other comment, and I know that there is, and this is, I would say, is probably the part where we kind of really differentiate ourselves from perhaps other more academic strains of MMT, where we don't emphasize as much this idea of marginal propensities to consume. From my perspective, you know, the people I talk to, and you know, I look at think about you know, households and spending, and look at you know, consumption paths. I mean, sure, it's correct to say that you know, higher income folks have a lower marginal propensity to consume. But they also have a much, much, much higher absolute level of consumption. And so when you think about like the highest spenders in the economy are the highest earners. And so that's something where and you know, one argument that we've made on this podcast, you know, one example that we gave was look at cruise lines, right? I was down in I was actually down in Miami, and I was at the JP Morgan Leveraged Finance Conference, and I posed a question there. I was with this kind of panel of retail consumer discretionary folks, and I said, you know, look, if you're a retired boomer, you know, boomers are by far the biggest spenders on, you know, travel and leisure, right? For obvious reasons. You know, you're retired, you're trying to live out your golden years, et cetera, so forth. So they spend a lot on cruises and stuff. Even if you had, you know, $100,000 in like I said, you know, just a savings account at a bank or something, over the course of a year, you know, assuming like a 4% rate, I mean, that's $4,000 of income that, you know, over the ZERP period you were not getting. And so like that has real, like that's real spending power that's being transferred, you know, to this specific cohort, right? The boomers obviously have the bulk of the financial assets in the economy, and they spend a lot of it on travel and leisure. And so logically, I would think that, you know, that might bode well for the cruise industry. And as it turns out, and there's other kind of, you know, if you think about, you know, how the you know, cruise operators work, like you kind of have this fixed supply you know, rooms to fill and voyages that you can execute in a given year. And you can't really add capacity, right? So it's kind of this interesting dynamic. And so I asked about this, I'm like, you know, are we seeing, you know, pricing power from the cruise operators because, you know, you've got a lot of essentially boomers that are accumulating all this newfound wealth. And literally the guy was like emphatically, yes, that there's basically, you know, then he talked about this sort of wealth transfer effect where, you know, retired couple might, you know, pay for a trip, pay for a cruise, not just for their kids, but also their grandkids. And, you know, it's this sort of broader sort of wealth transfer, as they're putting it. And yeah, I mean, I think, we did a little write-up on this at the house, you know, these cruise operators are, you know, they've been raising prices like crazy because there's just so much demand. But it's not just the demand for their services, but it's also you know, people are willing to pay higher prices because they have additional funds to spend on it. And so I, you know, want to challenge not the truthfulness of the marginal propensity to consume point. That's obviously, it's something that's sort of, it's an identity. It's obviously correct. What I would just challenge is how relevant it is in terms of actual economic outcomes. If you're sending money to the portion of the population that spends the most in on an absolute basis, you're probably or consumes the most on an absolute basis, you're probably going to get more consumption, right? Consumption increases as people's incomes increase.
Right. No, right. And the theory basically says no. I mean, and I probably that you're wrong. So, and then the question is whether empirically that's also wrong. But, you know, but the I think like what you're saying, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with anything you're saying about, you know, boomers having the wealth and they obviously have a propensity to spend. Well, nobody denies that. But I mean, my interpretation of the marginal propensity to spend is basically, you know, just if the government was to cut $1,000 check and send it to a household that's living paycheck by paycheck and ask what fraction of that $1,000 are they going to spend? As opposed to I send that $1,000 check to Bill Gates, you know, Bill Gates is going to ignore that check. Mm-hmm. The marginal propensity to consume out of that check, I guarantee you, is about probably going to be zero in this extreme example. And that household living by check, paycheck by paycheck, is probably going to spend all of it. So, you know, a marginal propensity to consume is one in one case and zero in the other. And then we can take the intermediate cases. So why is this a relevant idea? It's a relevant idea is because to the extent that, say, you want to generate economic stimulus in a depression, you might want to cut checks to kind of the high MPC people. First of all, they tend to be lower income. They're more in need. And you'll get more of a kick. Now, you know, so this logic says that the statement you made, no, if you want to give a big kick from these checks, you should give them to the boomers who have a lot of wealth because they're going to spend them on cruise lines. Yeah, I don't even believe that, to be quite honest. I mean, they're not even going to notice these $1,000 checks. You know, they're millionaires.
But basically, it's not $1,000 checks. That's my point. It's like what we're talking about. I mean, with the Bill Gates example, if you're worth $1 billion and you make 5%, what's that, 50 million? I mean, 50 million, that's like real. That's real money. And
I guarantee you, if you give $50 million to the hand of both guys, you're probably going to spend it all.
I mean, well, that's kind of my point. It's like, yeah, people are going to spend it. In the case of, I mean, I've talked to, you know, all of our parents here are boomers and my in-laws, and they all say I can't believe how much money I'm getting from, you know, just from, you know, bonds and checking accounts that was not necessarily.
So I'm not exactly sure what we're arguing here. So, I mean, there's first of all, I mean, I think if I hear you right, Ryan, I mean, you're not disputing the fact that the propensity to consume out of income or wealth might differ across the population.
Right.
Okay. You know, and if I'm living hand to mouth and I'm struggling to feed my child and you give me $10,000, I'm probably going to spend it all because my kids need clothes. I have to repair the fridge. I have to buy a lawnmower. I mean, I'm going to. Yeah. But if you give $10,000 to Bill Gates, you know, or some rich retired boomer, you know, they might spend a bit of it, but they might not spend all of it. Or I mean, so I think that's all that the idea is. It's just that. The marginal propensity to consume varies across households, and it kind of varies in a systematic way. Poorer households tend to spend a relatively large fraction of the disposable income. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, what follows from that, I don't know. But I mean, but that's the statement.
Yeah. Oh, I guess our pushback is more so just like how relevant is that in terms of thinking about outcomes?
You know, like I said, I mean, hypothetically, if you were to like a stimulus program, I mean, and you had the idea you wanted to stimulate aggregate demand and at the same time help disadvantaged households, you might want to target the lower end for two reasons. One, it might be kind of you might feel morally obliged. That's kind of the right thing to do to help the houses in need. And at the same time, you can count on them to kind of add even, I mean, that money's going to be soon out of their hands. It's going to be in the hands of Bill Gates.
Because he's going to spend it. But what's interesting, Dave, I'll just point out, I saw a statistic that said almost 60% of the coronavirus, stimulus, the American Rescue Plan and the, I forget all the different names, but it's almost 60%, which was targeted towards lower income households.
Yeah.
Was either saved or used to pay down debt.
Yep, correct. Yep, correct.
So that's not those funds being used for additional spending. It's funds being used to repair balance sheets.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have a colleague at the St. Louis Fed has written a nice paper on that exactly. But
wouldn't that kind of like run counter to this idea that like, oh, it's like 100 cents on every dollar sent to the lower income households gets spent?
No, I mean, the statement is that the marginal propensity to consume is different across different households, and that lower income households tend to have higher MPCs. That's not a statement that they're going to spend all of their checks on consumption. Uh-huh. They as they did, as you rightly point out, and my colleague at the St. Louis Fed pointed out as well, actually, it's Dave Wixer. He's now at the Atlanta Fed. Households used a large amount of those transfers to pay off debt, as you pointed out.
Yeah,
correct. Yes, but that doesn't take away from the statement that the MPCs are different.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
David, maybe you can. So this is I'm probably the most naive of kind of classical economics in this group here. Mm-hmm. When I was kind of making my case back in 2022 to 2023, because of the interest income would be very bullish for asset prices. And the common argument I got was marginal propensity to consume is just going to be higher for them. And it never clicked with me why that argument was coming back as kind of the counter to what I was saying. And so maybe it sounds like MPC is just literally that poor people have to spend their money more because they just have the bottom 50% is just closer to consuming everything that they always have at all times. Cool. And so, but my counter, at least that I came up with, and maybe this is why it never clicked with the people that I was kind of countering, because maybe there just isn't there. Mm-hmm. But my thought was, okay, so if the Fed's going to raise interest rates, mm-hmm. right, which also means that the future cost of doing business, right? So if we're trying to understand, create a contract for how, what something's going to cost in the future, if there's a higher interest rate, the cost of the loan in the future is going to be baked into that higher interest rate, right? So the future price, and you see this with like gold or other commodities where when it tracks the interest rate, right? So when the interest rate goes higher, the future cost of doing business, you see this in the term structure prices for commodities, right? That goes higher. And so my thought was, okay, yeah, that there might be this marginal propensity to consume and it'd be lower, but wealthy people also probably being kind of the capitalists and the job, the people who are paying their employees, right? So that they're just going to pass that right along to the employees, right? So in other words, my thought was, yeah, but there's going to be a pass through directly to workers from the kind of wealthy class for this higher interest, because of this higher interest rate. And then also the workers are also seeing that prices are going to go higher into the future, mm-hmm. and they're going to start demanding higher income. And, yeah. and so the thought is, yeah, things are going to get more expensive for everyone. And this is kind of the hope that you slow inflation down, yeah. right? Because, a mortgage is going to be, so much more than it was at a 0% rate, but they can also now go to their employer and say, hey, I need more money, right? The wife wants to buy we got to get a new home or whatever. And our family is ready.
Things are more expensive.
and the income is always there to supply that request for the higher income. am I just missing? And so the pushback was, yeah, well, marginal propensity to consume. Wouldn't that be, though, kind of a forced consumption, although it's not a consumption on goods and services, but it's more of a pass-through to workers to just
like
increase, to just increase their wages?
So the pushback you were getting, because you were bullish or bearish at that time?
I was bullish. Yeah, heading into 2023, I'm bullish because of all this interest, you know, the higher rates.
These bearish arguments were bringing the marginal propensity to consume against your argument?
Yeah, pretty much what they're saying is, the bondholders are going to be getting more money. True, but that money's never going to find its way into the real economy to actually extend growth. And my point was, no, capitalism still works.
No, you're right. I mean, that's right. I mean, at some point, they're not going to let their wealth. They're not like Scrooge McDuck. I mean, they're at some point, their nominal wealth is going to grow to the point where they're going to want to spend. And you know, to Ryan's point, you know, cruises and stuff like that, for sure.
Well, anytime you have like fixed,
but even if it's like, not spending on
like,
pure,
you just jack up prices if there's less demand.
Even if it's not spending on pure consumption like cruises, there's still wouldn't it? I guess my argument was, wouldn't it always if the thought is I'm going to raise interest rates to make a mortgage more expensive and that's going to crush demand?
Yeah,
that can never happen because the income is always there to be passed off to the people who
anyone with pricing power, basically.
Yeah, but you're only talking about interest income, the component of income that's interest income. What about the component of income that firms have to generate sales?
Which also comes from So that would also come from.
I'm not going to be particularly pleased. Firms are net debtors, by the way. They're not earning interest here. They're paying interest, and also if the demand. Yeah. So I mean, I guess I'll go back to my. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it is all I can say is this. You know, to kind of the macroeconomy is a complicated object. There's a lot of moving parts, and you know, I commend people who try to kind of make sense of how this system works, you know, and it's, I'm not so smart, to be quite honest. And so that's why I had to resort to mathematical models to kind of help keep the logic, make sure that things were consistent, you know, that, and so when I look at my models, you know, what you find in these models is almost anything can happen. Depending on where you are in the parameter space. And so I see, you know, like in the case of Warren's, you know, I can see merit Warren's point of view, but I mean, I kind of condition what he says. I see a lot of merit in what a lot of the things the MMT crowd has said, because I can see regions in the parameter space of my model that kind of are consistent with what they're saying. There's other parts of MMT I'm less sure of. I'm not so sure. I haven't studied things like, you know, the job guarantee or something like that. I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on, but anyways, what can I say? I mean, there's a lot of things, a lot of moving parts, a lot of things could happen. We just have to look at, you know, like I say, Douglas, let's try to look at cross-country experience to see if our priors are kind of corroborated.
Yeah.
Across countries, you know, to see how much evidence we can bring to bear. But I think it's rarely the case that you can point to just one thing, you know, gold standard, banks, monetary policy, energy price shocks. You know, it's rarely just kind of one thing. It's everything working together and how the institutions either reinforce things, you know, does the fiscal and monetary authority accommodate the banking sector or is it kind of like gold? I mean, all these. It's complicated, I guess. And so we have to, you know, maintain a certain degree of humility, of course, when we're discussing these ideas.
Definitely.
Well, David, I know that was longer than we expected, so very much appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. It was great to finally speak with you. And would love to if you're interested, would love to share some of the stuff we've worked on.
I am very much interested. Please send it to me. I mean, it's I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot from it. And a couple of things you raised, especially Douglas, send me the that material. I mean, we can connect on social media. Ryan, you also had that the deficit data, I think, you were talking about. I wouldn't mind seeing that. The issue that you say financial markets weren't talking about but should have been. I'd be interested to see that as well. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have a great afternoon.
Thanks a ton, man. Okay, it was a great discussion. Appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you. Bye-bye.